It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Lake Superior's shipping season is getting off to an early start this spring, 8 o'clock this morning. The first in line to go through the locks is a tugboat and barge combo, the Clyde S. Vanencavoort and Erie Trader.
About 7,000 ships use the Soo Locks each year, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers says that almost all of our country's iron ore travels through them.
But new tariffs and an uncertain economy may threaten some of this year's traffic.
To help us learn more about the causes and effects of this year's early start to the Great Lakes shipping season, Daniel Rust, he's an associate professor of transportation and logistics management at the UW-Superior, where he is also the director of the School of Business and Economics. Daniel, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So how far ahead of schedule are we with the Soo Locks opening this morning?
Just a few days. The scheduled date for each year that's set by federal regulation is March 25th, so we are a few days early this year.
And what does this mean for the Great Lakes shipping season as you see it, Daniel?
The companies that use the Great Lakes with their vessels, they get a jump start on movement of vessels through the Soo Locks. The Soo Locks are the only way in and out of Lake Superior, and so it is a vital lifeline for the Great Lakes and for our region to have this functioning. It's great that it could be early this year.
Can you describe the Soo Locks for us a little bit?
Certainly, the Soo Locks date way back into the 1800s when they were first developed. There's about a 21-foot difference between Lake Superior and the lake below, and so it's need to somehow get vessels up over that difference, and so the Soo Locks were developed. Currently, there are two. There's the McClellan Lock, the smaller, and then the Poe Lock, which is the larger lock that handles the largest vessels that transit the Great Lakes.
And which one opened this morning?
This morning was the Poe. Okay. The Poe is 1,200 feet long, and it can handle any of the vessels on the Great Lakes. And the MacArthur, the smaller, sometime in April next month, be opening that lock.
When and why are the four locks closed? When does that happen for the season?
So by federal regulation, it's January 15 is when the locks close at the Poe. And you might say, why actually set these dates in federal regulation? It gives certainty to all stakeholders to know when they will close and approximately when they will open. The regulations were been amended many times since 1950s. And actually been extended. Originally, it was mid-December as a closing date and into April before an official start of the season.
So to get these locks open, what did it take? Was there ice that had to be chipped off? And is that the reason why we have the Soo Lock opening this morning a little bit early this year?
Ice is a factor, but the predominant factor is that the Corps of Engineers, who maintains and operates the locks, they were able to get their work completed early, the maintenance work they've been doing on the lock. And so they were able to accommodate a request from the Lake Carriage Association to open the lock a little bit early.
Daniel, what's the maintenance look like for these locks? Are they dredging? Are they cleaning?
Mostly repairing machinery and making sure that it's all functioning properly. It's vital to have them, the locks, particularly the Poe, operational throughout the season. If the Poe were to for some reason go down during the season, it would be catastrophic for not just the regional economy, but the nation as a whole, particularly because of the iron ore that comes from Lake Superior to the lower lakes.
And these locks were put in place in the 1800s. What year was that again?
Correct. The Poe, I believe, was 1896 originally built, and then it was expanded in the 1960s, opened 1969 to its current dimensions. And that allows the Lakers, those ships that are vessels are captive to the Great Lakes, the largest, those 1,000-footers, to operate between Lake Superior and the lower lakes. Without that one lock, they could not move between the lakes and the we would have a very different supply chain if that were the case.
We're talking about the early start of the Lake Superior shipping season with Daniel Rust, Associate Professor of Transportation and Logistics Management at the UW-Superior. Thinking about shipping and trade here, tariffs come to mind. It's been in the news. So what do we know so far about how tariffs that are being proposed by President Trump could affect the shipping in the Great Lakes this season?
It definitely could have an impact, and it probably already has. The announcement yesterday by Cleveland-Cliffs that they're going to be idling a mine up on the Iron Range in Minnesota because they have really excess of taconite waiting, ready to go. And so with the threat of tariffs and the slowdown of auto manufacturing, demand for steel has declined, and they're anticipating lower demand. And so the supply will be less that's needed, which also then translates into less being transported on the Great Lakes and lower need for vessels moving those tonnages.
That taconite, it's a low-grade iron ore.
That's right. It's a low-grade iron ore. It's mixed with other ingredients, so it's all ready to go into the blast furnaces at the steel mill. And it was a great invention back in the 1950s that allows year-round, if even the coldest weather, can move taconite. It's basically a small marble-like shape, and it flows easily, unlike the raw iron of the previous generations that would freeze solid into rail cars and ships. And the taconite has been a great invention and something that allows for year-round use of those.
During the first Trump administration, the president approved federal funding for the Poe Lock in hopes it would help the shipping industry in the Great Lakes. Is there any understanding about whether there is federal support for what are you monitoring in terms of what's next in terms of federal actions and shipping on the Great Lakes, Daniel?
That's a great question. So far, there seems to be a clear consensus that it's a priority to build the second Poe-sized lock, the 1,200-foot lock. It's under construction currently. It started in about 4 years ago now with building this. It's a $3 billion project and a lot of federal money to make this happen. And say, why do we need a second 1,200-foot lock? As I mentioned, if the current Poe lock were to go down during a season, it would be catastrophic and need to have some resilience built into the system. And having a second lock that of similar size would allow, wouldn't just have to be during the winter season to repair one of the locks. If one lock is down, the other be operational and would build that resilience into our supply chains. And so far, it seems like most all stakeholders are in agreement that we need to move forward and continue to fund the second 1,200-foot lock.
And when is the estimated date of completion if the funding were to continue as is?
Currently, as I understand it, 2031 would be the date of opening.
Are there bottlenecks in the Soo Locks, Daniel? Do we see transportation getting held up there at all with the limited locks that are there now?
Typically, no. Typically isn't too bad. Ice can be an issue certain parts of the year to make sure the vessels can transit that. But with traffic, the Corps does a wonderful job, coordinates with other stakeholders, and it can be a choke point, but it's a pretty cooperative effort by everyone involved on both sides of the border to make sure that traffic flows efficiently and effectively through the Soo Locks.
Yeah, I really wanted to ask you about that as the Associate Professor of Transportation and Logistics Management at the UW-Superior with an estimated 7,000 ships going through these locks every season. What does logistics look like on a daily basis and how long term do you have to plan out to get your ships through? What's it like to go through the Soo Locks as a shipping industry?
It's really an amazing experience to go through the Soo Locks. If no one's ever in our audience has watched it, definitely go to Sault Ste. Marie and watch the vessels as they transit through this wonder. It's a linchpin of North American supply chains, and particularly as we think of these bulk commodities. So iron ore, I had mentioned, but also grain and coal and limestone and rock salt. And other commodities that move through there, as well as some of the imports, such as wind energy components that would come to the Great Plains, would typically come through the St. Lawrence Seaway all the way up to Duluth Superior and then by land to their final destination.
So, who's scheduling all these trips through these locks to make sure that there aren't the bottlenecks with the limited passage that they have?
That's the beauty of logistics. That is the coordinators that make that happen, and it's their job to make sure that the vessels are operating as they should be and coordinate that movement of all these vessels. And that's one thing we train people for here in our program at UW Superior, is those professionals who are behind the scenes that make all this happen. And when they do their job right, nobody hears about it.
We were talking about the Panama Canal before the show this morning. And, you know, when you hear about it, you hear about it when something goes wrong. The coordinators, are they public? Are they private? Who are the coordinators of the SULACs?
So mostly it'd be private companies that would coordinate and make sure that their vessels are getting through in a timely manner. And it's really, say, it's an amazing system of cooperation. I think you talk about Trump policies. One thing that could have a real impact on the Great Lakes would be the drawdown of employees of NOAA. And that's the National Oceanic Atmospheric Agency that oversees the weather reporting, also ice coverage, monitor that. And it could have a real impact on just that the knowledge base that carriers have and monitoring conditions on the Great Lakes. And so that's something that is on the radar screen, so to speak, of everyone.
Wouldn't necessarily have made that connection between a reduction in staff at NOAA and the challenges that we have in coordinating the logistics through the SULACs every season. Daniel, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Daniel Rust, Associate Professor of Transportation and Logistics Management at the UW-Superior. He is also the director of the School of Business and Economics there. We talked about the early start to Lake Superior shipping season and the potential effects of tariffs from the Trump administration.
More than 130 lawsuits have been filed against the Trump administration since January. Hear from Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call on some of these cases and the powers of government.
We've already got the Trump administration ignoring Congress. If it starts ignoring the courts, that's a massive constitutional crisis.
That conversation is next on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Lee Rayburn. The NFL Draft is coming to Green Bay next month, and the event will be bringing tens of thousands of visitors with it.
Joe Schultz has more on how the smallest city in pro sports is getting ready for the NFL's largest off-season event.
Each year, all 32 NFL teams select the best college football players in the country to join their rosters. Some of those picks can be a pretty big deal.
The Green Bay Packers select Rashawn Gary,
Jordan Love,
Clay Matthews,
Brian Bulaga,
Aaron Rodgers, quarterback in California.
The draft has grown into the league's largest off-season event, transforming from a televised league meeting to a football festival. Since 2015, the NFL has taken the show on the road. In Detroit last year, the three-day event drew more than 700,000 people. Green Bay is the smallest U.S. city that has a major professional sports team. Around 240,000 people are expected to attend the draft here, or around 80,000 a day. Earlier this month, more than 50 residents of the neighborhood around Lambeau Field attended a meeting put on by the Packers and tourism leaders about how the draft will affect their daily lives. Local leaders described it as essentially hosting three Packers home games in a row.
There's going to be lots of parking available, just like you're all familiar with on game days.
Jeannie DeGroat lives near Lambeau. She worries the city won't be able to handle the influx of people.
I have been telling people for a long time that if you're going to come to the draft to Green Bay, that come this year, because it may never, ever come back.
Other neighbors, like Reed Lewis, are more confident.
Hopefully the weather will cooperate and it'll
turned out to be the best thing Green Bay ever had.
Even DeGroat says she left the meeting feeling cautiously optimistic. Green Bay landed the draft after the Packers and tourism officials spent nearly a decade working behind the scenes to bring the event to town. More than 50 million people watched the draft on television last year. Officials say hosting it will have a statewide economic impact of as much as $94 million. And Green Bay Mayor Eric Genrich sees it as an opportunity to showcase the community to a national audience.
We're the smallest community in the NFL, but we've got the biggest heart by a long shot.
During the event, the NFL Draft Theater will be in the northeast corner of the Lambeau Field parking lot. That's where the league commissioner will announce the first-round selections on opening night.
The 2023 NFL Draft is now officially open.
It's the part of the event that fans are most familiar with, but it's essentially a televised business meeting. There will be lots of other activities around Lambeau.
There's also a huge football festival that accompanies what's happening on the stage. So it's interactive games, the Vince Lombardi Trophy, the full collection of Super Bowl rings. It's food. It's a Wisconsin supper club where we have a number of local restaurants curating the food and beverage.
That's Nikki Yule. She's the NFL's senior director of events. She was in Green Bay earlier this month for the league's final production and planning visit before the draft. Other local activities away from the stadium include concerts, a cooking competition, and a skills challenge at the field the Packers used before Lambeau. Genrich says those events came from conversations with local leaders in cities that previously hosted the draft.
This is a great opportunity for the city, but you really have to do everything you can to take advantage of it, because the NFL's focus, rightfully so, is on the event itself.
While officials are optimistic everything will go off without a hitch, hosting the NFL's biggest off-season event in its smallest city does pose obstacles. There are fewer hotel rooms in Green Bay than larger cities that have previously hosted the draft. And an April snowstorm in Wisconsin isn't totally outside the realm of possibility. Even so, Genrich says he's confident in organizers and the community.
We've got a really good group of people in place to make sure that regardless of what happens, you know, people are going to stay safe and have a good time.
The NFL Draft runs from April 24th through the 26th. Admission to the event is free. Joe Schultz, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And for more information on the logistics of attending the NFL Draft, visit greenbay.com/draft25.
More than 130 lawsuits have been filed against the Trump administration since January. That's according to a database maintained at New York University. About two dozen cases are challenging the administration's Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE.
Wisconsin is party to some of those suits relating to DOGE's attempts to access Americans' personal data and firings of federal employees.
Here in Wisconsin, Republican lawmakers formed a committee that aims to make government more streamlined. It's called GOAT, the Committee on Government Oversight, Accountability, and Transparency.
I spoke with Attorney General Josh Call on Tuesday about the state's lawsuit against DOGE. Call starts by explaining what court actions he seeks to prioritize against the Trump administration.
So with any multi-state litigation, I look at basically two issues to determine when to get Wisconsin involved. One is the policy that's being challenged something that's harmful to Wisconsinites? And in all of the cases that we're involved in right now, there are clear harms to people in our state. And then secondly, is there a strong legal basis for challenging the policy that's at issue? So where we have gotten involved, these are cases that have met those standards, and we're pushing back to protect the best interests of the people of Wisconsin.
I wonder, in this multi-state litigation, I mean, currently there are 23 Democratic attorneys general in this country. Are you in agreement with how to respond to the Trump administration?
We've worked together closely in preparing for the Trump administration and then as this administration has moved forward. And sometimes we have differences of opinion as to which types of cases to get involved in or even where to file cases. So there, you know, with birthright citizenship, for example, there are two separate cases going on involving AGs. There's one that most of us are involved in, but then there's a second one in a different state. But what we are all committed to, I'm confident, is working together to protect the rule of law and our Constitution and the best interests of the people of our state.
State Attorneys General brought a case against President Trump and Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent challenging DOGE access to Treasury Department records. What are you arguing in this case?
The basic argument is that when policies are adopted, there's federal law that requires that they be adopted in a particular way. In that case, we argued they didn't go about doing that. And we won a preliminary injunction, an order from the judge that prevents DOGE, at least for the time being, from accessing sensitive Treasury data. And there we're also concerned about the privacy harms that come from allowing people who haven't even gone through the basic security training, though they're now working to address that, but allowing them access to some of the most sensitive data that people have, and also data that could cause major catastrophe for our economy if it were to be disrupted somehow or corrupted.
Is the actions of DOGE in Treasury records, is that rising to the level of a data breach, of a cybersecurity breach?
Well, a lot of people who are experts in this area have commented about how the access that DOGE has gotten to not just Treasury data, but other data throughout the government would, in a lot of contexts, be considered a massive data breach and a data security issue that's really unrivaled. And there's been a lot of secrecy around what DOGE is doing. To this day, we don't know precisely what's happening with DOGE, what it's doing with the information that it's getting. We do know that it's putting out a lot of false information. There have been a lot of claims from Musk about fraud that he's identifying and other things like this. But the limited information they have provided publicly was then largely retracted because what they're doing is really unclear to us. And so the sooner that the Trump administration is forthcoming, the sooner that Americans can have confidence that their confidential data is being protected.
In terms of the Privacy Act of 1974, meant to protect people's data from government overreach, is this a particular piece of law that the multi-state litigation is considering in its argument?
Yeah, when we're working on the Treasury case, we've raised a variety of legal arguments, as I mentioned, and making sure that people's privacy rights are protected, that our administrative rules are followed, and that the laws that are passed by Congress are being respected. One of the really troubling things we've seen from the Trump administration in a number of cases is the argument that when they are executing the laws, that they're basically constitutionally entitled to ignore what Congress has done. They're asserting sweeping power under Article 2 of the Constitution, which is the article that gives power to the president. What they're suggesting would basically make numerous acts of Congress pointless. Now, the other thing we're seeing that's very concerning is disregard for court orders, at least in public statements from the Trump administration. We have three branches of the federal government. We've got the executive, Congress, and the courts. We've already got the Trump administration ignoring Congress. If it starts ignoring the courts, that's a massive constitutional crisis. We're already in really uncharted territories, but this is really troubling rhetoric we're hearing.
Right, because generally our government system is built on these checks and balances, three co-equal branches of government. And you know, there might not be this set definition or clear agreement about when the U.S. actually enters a constitutional crisis, but what are your thoughts on this at the moment?
I think that the foundations of our Constitution and our democracy are clearly being tested by the Trump administration in a variety of different ways. We're seeing that through disregard of acts of Congress. When the U.S. Supreme Court concluded that the president had the sweeping immunity for official acts, it helped set us on this very dangerous course. And the Trump administration is really using that immunity to take all sorts of actions that would have been considered clearly out of bounds previously. We've got a Congress that so far has done very little to push back against the Trump administration. And then we're seeing the administration also weaponize the justice system, threaten people who are exercising their First Amendment rights. So for those of us who care deeply about the Constitution and the rule of law, we are facing a major challenge right now. But having the courts hold the line on protecting people's rights and our constitutional system is really critical. So far, it's been highly successful, but it's critical that continues.
Right. So far, it's been this patchwork of injunctions and court orders in this deluge of litigation and watching whether the Trump administration will change course or will change its agenda.
That's right. And I think it's really important that we not only focus on the constitutional aspect of this, but we talk about the real life impacts that are being threatened here. The good news is, because the success of these suits has happened, we haven't seen all of the harm that we might have. But just as an example, the effort to freeze federal funding for a period of time, that would have had catastrophic consequences for all sorts of critical programs. And, you know, there's been a lot of coverage about the impact that occurred even with the orders that were in place to programs like Meals on Wheels or Head Start, which led to daycares not being opened. But when you've got a White House that is absolutely bent on moving forward with these dangerous policies, we're going to see impacts. And so we're beginning to see concerns about the ability of the Social Security Administration to continue doing its job effectively. There's obviously a major concern about cuts to Medicaid. So we are on the precipice of some real harms. And some people, like some of the veterans and scientists who were laid off in these probationary firings, are already seeing real harms.
We are talking with State Attorney General Josh Call about Wisconsin's involvement in litigation against actions taken by DOGE, Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency. Let's turn to lawsuits regarding the firing of federal employees. How is the Trump administration? I mean, Wisconsin had about 3,000 probationary federal employees who have been in their jobs between 1 and 2 years, and that's from FedScope data, the federal civilian workforce data. How are Wisconsinites affected by these firings, and what is the involvement of our Justice Department in this litigation?
Well, like a lot of states around the country, we have Wisconsinites who are our federal employees, and some of those employees, as you just mentioned, are in probationary status. That generally means they're pretty early in the particular job that they're in. One of the things I would note, by the way, is that a disproportionate percentage of our federal employees are themselves veterans. But what the Trump administration has done here is similar to what we've been talking about in these other contexts. There's a process in place for reductions in force, efforts to downsize federal employment. But among other things, that requires 60 days notice. And what the Trump administration did was they simply ignored those laws, and they just decided to lay people off without the notice required. They're also required to give notice to the states, which they didn't do. So we brought this action to ensure that they are following federal law. But it's a pattern of lawlessness that we're seeing with the Trump administration. And that's part of the reason we keep winning these cases. You know, I'd love to tell you it's because we're all such brilliant lawyers and we're so effective. And while I think we're making strong arguments, the reality is that we keep winning these cases against very difficult standards. It's not easy to get a preliminary order, but we're winning because the Trump administration is consistently, flagrantly violating the law. That's what happened with these probationary employees. And we very quickly got an order requiring that those employees be reinstated and that the effort to fire those probationary employees stops.
But with Democratic attorneys general like yourself working on these particular high-level cases involving the Trump administration, does that leave you time and ability to work on cases like the opioid settlement, for instance, or other litigation that perhaps gets sidelined in this moment?
Well, certainly we would rather not be using resources having to ensure that the federal government is following the law. We would rather be using all those resources on our other priorities. But at the same time, we've got to put our resources where they can have the biggest impact. And so we don't get involved in cases challenging the federal government unless we feel like those two standards are met that I mentioned before. And if you look at our track record so far, I think you can see that we've selected wisely where to get involved. And we've also benefited from working collaboratively with other states around the country, some of which have far more resources in their AG's offices than ours does. But nevertheless, you know, it's always my hope that the federal government works consistently with the law and that we can find common ground. But so far, what we're seeing from the Trump administration and from these reckless policy decisions that Elon Musk and the president and his administration are making, we've seen a need to step up and protect the rights of Wisconsinites.
And as we talk about DOGE, here in Wisconsin, we see Republican lawmakers creating a committee mirroring DOGE called the Government Operations Accountability and Transparency, or GOAT Committee. And I just want to take a listen here. Republican Representative David Steffen talking on a program this week about the committee's first meeting.
it was actually a follow-up to a legislative audit, and so provides an opportunity to ask more in-depth questions, get more information, things that the audit committee itself has not asked. This is something that the people have demanded, more accountability, more responsiveness, more information out to the public, and so that's our goal.
What do you make of that? What do you make of the Assembly Committee looking into efficiencies and other things here in Wisconsin?
Well, I think what happens here in Wisconsin remains to be seen. I mean, we are all committed to making sure that our government is working efficiently and that taxpayer dollars are being used wisely. We take a lot of pride in doing that here at DOJ and making sure that there's transparency for the public into the operations of government, I think is a great goal. What I hope we don't see, and I'm optimistic we won't, is the kind of thing we've seen with Elon Musk, where the committee works in a way that is not at all transparent, where they are having unfettered access into agencies, and where they are making rash decisions without any input from the people who would be impacted, or in some cases, even much understanding of what they're doing. I don't think we're going to see that in Wisconsin. And so to the extent that we can work to continue working to improve efficiency, that's great. But I don't think anybody who's watched closely how Musk and Doge have been doing their work wants to see that model emulated here in Wisconsin.
Attorney General Call, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That is Wisconsin's Attorney General Josh Call. Talked about why Wisconsin joined multi-state litigation over layoffs of federal employees and attempts to access personal financial information. We spoke on Tuesday.
Ahead on Wisconsin Today, three eggs, a couple of bald eagles, one live nature cam, and a whole lot of people waiting anxiously for what's next.
We should start seeing a hatch come up here in about a week and a half to 2 weeks.
Keeping an eye on the eagles overlooking Trempealeau, coming up on WPR News. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Lee Rayburn.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here is producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a group of dancers.
There's a dance studio owner in Madison who's been recruiting instructors to come work with her. Many of them are from her home country, Ukraine. As war has raged on in the Eastern European country, these instructors have moved across the world to start new lives in Wisconsin. And dance is one way they stay connected to their Ukrainian culture. WPR's Jonah Balekas visited the Fred Astaire Dance Studios to learn what dance means to these Ukrainians.
Pairs of dancers glide across the floor as the sun drenches the Fred Astaire Dance Studio in Madison. Couples sway their hips as they each practice unique dances, including rumba and other styles of ballroom dance. Most of these students are being taught by instructors who grew up in Ukraine. According to the studio's owner, Tatiana Lutsenko, ballroom dance in Ukraine is like basketball or football in the United States. Dance is deeply embedded in the country's way of life from an early age.
In Ukrainian culture, it's very common that all of the kids, as soon as they start to walk, they start to dance. So I also start in a very early age.
Lutsenko has been with the studio for about 9 years. When she thinks about her mission, she thinks big. She wants to enrich life through the power of dance. That can mean getting healthier through movement, or it can mean boosting self-esteem by dressing up in beautiful costumes.
A single woman who say, I feel so feminine and I feel great about myself. Couples who've been married for several years and now they start to kiss each other and go to dates together. So that's probably the biggest thing that we do, that we change in life.
But dance offers something different for nearly all the instructors at this Fred Astaire dance studio, a connection to their home country. Some, like Lutsenko, moved to the U.S. from Ukraine before Russia's invasion in 2022. Others more recently fled the violence. All worry if they will have a home to return to, or if it will ever resemble the country they left. Alexandra Babienko is from Zaporizhia, the same hometown as Lutsenko. The two used to dance together in Ukraine. Babienko says she's been happy to share ballroom dancing with Americans. It makes her proud to be Ukrainian.
It's hard to explain because it's more than just hobby or more than just like sport you do. It's more like lifestyle. So you're a dancer from like childhood. It's like you're a doctor. Same things.
Babienko says when the war started, she and others were always on their phones, even during Wisconsin dance competitions. Over time, she said it became too hard to wake up every night checking to see what happened.
You feel like you cannot help. Like, you can do physically absolutely nothing to help those people. That was the worst part. You cannot go there, you cannot see them, you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, today, so that was the hardest part for me.
Katerina Zazulia started dancing in Ukraine when she was 4 years old. It has become her entire life. She says it's how she expresses herself and disappears from the world. She says it hurts to watch the news, but she takes care of herself by...
dancing. Yeah, that's pretty much it. I'm trying... this is happening, this has happened to me, this is emotionally hard. I'm trying to come to my working place to give people positive energy, and that's what helps me to stay positive.
Studio owner Lutsenko has tried to adapt to life while her home country is at war. Every Saturday, she talks with her mom, who is still in Ukraine. Even if they don't have much to share, she just wants to know that her mom is okay. She's finding other ways to help her fellow Ukrainians.
Let me bring families of my friends. Let me help them. So let's try to help them to find a job here in the United States or maybe find apartments. So for me, my friends or my employee become my second family, and everything that I could not give back to Ukraine, at least I try to kind of give them here while they're here in the United States.
And perhaps they can find a piece of their home in Madison, too.
WPR's Jonah Balekas brought us that story on Ukrainian dancers in Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Wisconsin Today.
And this is Mrs. and Mr. T.
You're hearing a pair of bald eagles in Trempealeau, Wisconsin. This once endangered species has made a remarkable comeback in our state, and recently the Raptor Resource Project wanted to bring this pair of nesting eagles to the masses.
On a free webcam, people can view these two eagles nesting, laying eggs, and soon we'll be able to watch baby eagles emerge from their shells as hatching season is in early spring.
The webcam comes courtesy of the Raptor Resource Project in Decorah, Iowa, founded in 1989 by the late Bob Anderson.
The Raptor Resource Project now has about a dozen live nature cams that you can stream, and they feature eagles and falcons, kestrels and vultures.
So to learn about the Trempealeau eagles and the other Wisconsin-based projects, we have Executive Director of the Raptor Resource Project, John Howe. John, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hey, great to be here.
So you've started monitoring Mr. and Mrs. T, who are up on the Eagle Cam now through the Raptor Resource Project, at some point last year. What have we learned about this couple, and what are their personalities like?
We did all the installation in the fall of 2023. So you're right, last year was our first live cam year. And we think that there's been a few changes. We may have had a new male last year, and we think that we might have a new female this year. And interestingly, bald eagles, the females, have a different egg-laying pattern between different females. So we noticed that we had 2 eggs last year during the season, and this year we have 3 eggs. So it kind of led us to believe that there's a possibility that we've got a new female this year.
So for folks who tune into the Eagle Cam now, what would you expect to see from Mr. and Mrs. T?
So basically, we're in the incubation stage for the bald eagle. And basically, that incubation period is, it can vary, but basically it's around 34 to 36 days. So if I went through and did the math and looked at my calendar, I think we would have about a week and a half, maybe 2 weeks more before we'll start expecting to see a potential hatch starting. So we're basically looking at adult eagles changing back and forth with their incubation duties, and both the male and the female eagle do that. And we should start seeing a hatch come up here in about a week and a half to 2 weeks.
One of the things I've noticed, John, is how careful and clean Mr. and Mrs. T are with their nest and how they tend to it almost obsessively. You said now that there's a language for bald eagles in their nesting habits. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. You know, over the years, the Raptor Resource Project, one of the first things was the viral bald eagle nest in Decorah, the Decorah eagles that started with worldwide viewing back in 2011. And there have been enthusiasts, bald eagle watchers, basically, that have come up with, a lot of them are moderators that we've had over the years, and they've come up with their own language basically for all the different little things that happen in the nest and little characteristics and traits and things like that. So for instance, the actual list of different items and what they're called and what they refer to is called the diction airy, although airy is spelled like what a raptor nest is called, and that's an airy. So diction airy is just one example of the slightly modified eagle Eaglish. It's not English, it's Eaglish, eagle speaking terms. So it's pretty interesting. To get the full flavor of that, I think we've got a live chat that folks can drop in on and ask questions. We've got moderators on this nest like almost every day between, twice a day there's a chat open that folks can log in and watch the cam and ask questions and
speak
just
some
enjoy.
English. We're talking about the eagles in Wisconsin with John Howe, executive director of the Raptor Resource Project. They recently started a publicly available webcam to watch two bald eagles in Trempealeau, Mr. and Mrs. T. John, what do you see as the value, and what are we learning from this webcam footage that we're getting?
This nest is a little bit different than many that we have. A lot of the nests that we have are in cottonwood trees, and cottonwoods are pretty abundant near water sources. And water sources, either a lake or a river, is pretty much prime territory for bald eagles because their primary diet is fish. So mostly cottonwoods, but our north nest in north of Decorah, that nest is actually in a white oak. For the Trempealeau eagles, they're in a pine tree, a white pine tree. And it's a little bit different if you've been into the northern part of Wisconsin or know the difference of the wind blowing through a regular deciduous tree versus a pine tree. There's just that gentle whispering of the wind going through the tree and the branches and the boughs kind of moving around when the weather and the wind picks up. But this one specifically is in a white pine tree, and it's about 67, almost 70 feet off the ground, about 65, I think, when we measured it. It's been there for several years. These can get up to be, you know, at least a ton or more, the weight of these nests, depending on if they're wet with rain and a lot of material.
The nest can weigh a ton?
A ton or more. Yeah, I was going to say, we've seen nests come down on the Wisconsin side of the Mississippi River, just south of Winona. There was a characteristic nest that it almost looked like a big champagne glass, you know, this really long, V going up between branches of the tree, and that one finally came down this past year. But some of these nests have been around for decades, and the eagles just keep building on top. We built a nest for our North Nest eagles, the Decora North Nest eagles, just this last summer. That came down because of soggy, wet conditions, high winds, and we rebuilt a starter nest, and they've put at least, it's got to be at least 2.5 feet of material on top of that starter nest that we did already. So they are avid nest builders, and they do a lot of bringing in sticks into the nest. And we can talk about looking at that nest. I'm looking at it right now. There's a lot of different areas even of the nest, depending on what is and what activity is going to be there.
But I don't want to forget this. You're also tracking golden eagles in Wisconsin, and you had a golden eagle in January that gave you a bit of surprise. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so our multi-year golden eagle study of the eastern population here, not much is known about the golden eagles that winter here in the Driftless area and the western part of Wisconsin. And so up until this year, we had trapped and put solar-powered GPS transmitters on golden eagles. We had 13 of them that we've backpacked, and we call them our research partners. And they go all the way up to the Arctic, up to Nunavut, Hudson Bay area during the summer months. And that's where their nesting area is. And they come down here for food in the winter and bringing their young down. So we started out at 13, and we were able to trap and take scientific measurements and take blood samples and get information from 8.
And you trapped one of the oldest?
Yes. So a 32-year-old male golden eagle that had a band on it. So that was quite a surprise for Abby Crumry, who was part of the Abby and Anna. They were the team that trapped that golden eagle. And they were able to track, and we were able to communicate with the initial person that banded that back in Pennsylvania. So quite a story. All those years, 32 years later, for a bander to have somebody find an eagle that they had banded that many years ago. But yes, the oldest on record golden eagle in North America.
Wow. John Howe will be keeping a close eye on Mr. and Mrs. T and their 3 eggs as they get ready to hatch. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome.
John Howe is the executive director of the Raptor Resource Project based in Decorah, Iowa. It manages projects throughout Wisconsin. The organization recently launched a webcam in Trempealeau along the Mississippi River. It monitors a pair of bald eagles who are named Mr. and Mrs. T. You can watch their nest at raptorresource.org and keep an eye out for those 3 eggs to hatch over the next couple of weeks. Next Thursday on the show, we talk with a Wisconsin farmer and the owner of a local diner about the ongoing high cost of eggs.
But before we do, we want to know if egg prices have changed. What's on your plate? Have you found egg alternatives that you'd recommend? Have you stopped going out for breakfast, or have you cut back at home?
Here in Madison, I've noticed that some of the organic and free-range eggs are now about as affordable as what used to be the cheap ones.
So share your, egg experiences, if you will, with us. And we'd like to air them as part of the discussion. You can email wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text to get in touch. That number is 888-642-0232. Once again, it's 888-642-0232.
was excellent. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Lee Rayburn.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.